Well, it's been kind of an amazing night already. If you're just tuning in right now, you may have missed the story we just had on a few minutes ago from Todd Standing, including the audio that his expedition had recorded of a Bigfoot growl. This was captured on a video camera with a woman who was on his first expedition. And you could, he said, if you saw the video, you would see the tree branches move as snow fell from them as this Bigfoot moved away. And yet that's not the only audio we have for you this evening. We'll get back to Autumn Williams and her audio coming up in just a minute. And I want to play the what we just played there for with Todd Standing. I want to play that for her and compare the audio that she has on Bigfoot in just a few minutes. But also, if you missed it earlier, Gary Patterson had an update on the Jim Morrison is alive story, or rather, how did Jim Morrison die, perhaps, story, and the possibility that they're going to exhume the tomb and or exhume the body out of the tomb, I guess. And then earlier, even still, the story from Steeleville, Illinois, from Dennis Cole, the editor of the newspaper there, on a story that is being reported as factual, not collected secondhand, but directly from the principals involved, of a man who was seen sitting on the railroad tracks who sat up just as a Canadian train hit him. They put on the brakes. They went back to find the body. They called the local authorities, the whole bit. Nothing, not a drop. Not any sign at all that anybody had been there. Dennis Cole investigating, find out it was at that exact spot many decades ago that somebody had committed suicide by sitting in the exact same way that the train had hit that person. If you missed it, go back and listen to the first hour on Streamlink. It's something which may re require some follow-up on its own on the way. And then also to tell you that the blog is up at coasttocoastam.com, lower left-hand corner. Go link onto that to kind of take a further thought about the death of Pat Tillman from the Arizona Cardinals and whether or not he was the victim of a murder mystery that is ongoing and whose evidence may be out there right now if the Army would only cooperate. I'm trying to support the Tillman family by finding out what really happened to Pat Tillman. Find out more about that at coasttocoastam.com. Autumn Williams and her audio from Bigfoot next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Amber Williams is here. Would it be fair to say Amber? Oh, sorry, it says here Amber, but it's Autumn, right?
It's Autumn. Amber's
Yeah.
actually my sister, believe it or not.
Well, it's here. Let me tell you what the bio says. It said Amber Williams started out as a childhood witness and began conducting field research at the tender age of 16. Is that you or your sister that the bio was written about?
All of that is correct, except the name is Autumn, not Amber. I
Oh,
don't know how you got Amber.
I don't know either. It just says it on my page.
Mommy
And
used to
I,
call me Fred.
that's all right. So now, how old are you then, Autumn?
I'm 33.
Okay, so you've spent over half of your life looking for Bigfoot.
Yes, I have.
That's way cool. And your family has kind of sort of had this be sort of a family tradition.
Well, the deal is, I'm kind of unique in the research field in that I'm one of the few, if not the only, researcher who is who was the child of a family of ongoing witnesses. So that's always kind of given me a unique perspective. And when I was 16, I kind of came into the Bigfoot community, and I found a lot of resistance in the mainstream research community about long-term witnesses, which really kind of blew me away because I knew that my family had had these experiences, and I figured that there were other people around who had as well. Well, I
What?
ended up finding those people all across the country, but even now, there is still such an amazing resistance in the research community toward these types of witnesses, and I still don't understand it.
Well, I don't think I understand it either. I mean, you would think that if you, I mean, I would, if you had had ongoing experiences measured over generations with your family because of where you lived and what you were willing to do to try to find them, that you would be a gold mine for these researchers.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, all things equal, if you have an incidental witness, and this is somebody who's seen a Bigfoot cross the road, and you have a long-term witness who has lived with Bigfoot in their backyard for, say, 3, 4, 5 years and has had limited but ongoing interactions. All things equal, if both of these witnesses are telling the truth, you can interview that incidental witness for 3 hours, and the only thing that you're going to learn from them is what a Bigfoot looks like crossing the road. But I think part of the resistance, it's twofold. I think part of it is because rural witnesses aren't always ideal witnesses. They're not sophisticated often. They're not educated. They're not the kind of people that would work in a 9-to-5 job in the Sears Tower, that kind of deal. I mean, they're rural folks and kind of salt of the earth people. And I think the other thing too is that researchers expect these witnesses to have such, you know, huge volumes of photographic evidence. This is the first thing they say is, well, where are all the pictures? If you see Bigfoot all the time, where are all the pictures?
Right.
What they don't understand is that long-term witnesses, first of all, if they see Bigfoot, they know Bigfoot exists. And they're not really interested in flashing a flashbulb in this creature's face when what they're trying to do is develop a habituation with these creatures.
And by habituation, you mean some sort of cohabituation?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a happiness to be in the same area at the same time.
Exactly. I mean, these people are not researchers, they're witnesses. That's a really, really big distinction. They are not out to, I mean, they don't have the technology, they don't have the sophistication, they don't have the interest in bringing this to the world and compromising the stuff that they already have going on. Because they usually, in most cases, they think it's pretty neat. And there's this trust and this rapport that develops. You know,
Before you go further down that road,
okay.
Let me just say what I learned from Todd Standing. We were having this conversation, and he says that that Bigfoot are very reclusive, that they live in groups, that they will have a sentinel that'll be out looking for any sign of human, and that if they come across a human, that the word will go out. They know about us long before we ever see them, and that's why they will evacuate an area, leave a domicile behind, as he said, and just move on the second that they have human interaction. And that sounds different than what you're describing, which is essentially species becoming good neighbors in the same area.
I don't disagree with much of what Todd said there, what you're rephrasing to me. I don't disagree with much of that. But these long-term witness scenarios are very unique. Usually it's a family where the women and children are home during the day and the gentleman of the house is off, you know, earning the bread. And they seem to be very drawn toward women and children, and that doesn't surprise me at all, because women and children react to fear situations differently than men do in most cases.
I don't know about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, men have a tendency, all anger is fear-based. No matter how you're angry, if you're jealous, if you're full of hatred, if you're furious, if you're screaming at somebody because they almost ran you off the road, regardless of why you're angry because you're afraid. Anger is a secondary emotion. Fear is the base emotion, always. And I mean always. So when men get angry, men have a tendency to try to regain control of a situation when they're afraid. And so if a man is out in the dark and something scares him, he will more than likely grab a flashlight, grab a gun, I'm gonna go get that sucker, you know, that kind of thing. Women have a tendency to be a little more open to see what's going to happen before they, you know, before they react. And I think, I honestly really believe that these creatures know that. I mean, they've become aware of that over the however long it's been that they've been interacting with us as human beings, that they recognize the difference between how men and women react, and so they generally seem to be more drawn toward women and children. 90% of my long-term witnesses that I've worked with over 17 years have been women staying home with kids.
Okay. You may have heard, we played audio tape of Todd Standing, and there was a woman that was in the audio. So I guess that would be consistent with what you're saying, is that somehow the Bigfoot would be attracted to the woman that had the camera. Did you hear the audio that we played?
I heard it briefly, yeah. It wasn't of a quality, you know, that I could really discern anything one way
let's
or
go ahead.
another.
Let's play it. Let's play it here, and again, just so you can hear. Maybe this quality is better on Coast to Coast AM. The Todd standing audio. Go ahead.
Hello. Oh my God.
Okay, it sounded like almost like the low growl of a chainsaw, kind of in the background. It had that sort of a rumble to it. Is that consistent with the Bigfoot sounds that you have heard over the years?
You know, I couldn't hear it well enough to really tell you one way or another. I can tell you what I know about the vocalizations, and maybe from that you can make up your own mind about it. I can't give you an opinion one way or another, though, because the audio just it's simply I can't hear what's going on in it. There's too much background noise.
Okay, what would be the things that you would have us listen for in a Bigfoot vocalization?
Here's the deal. Witnesses pretty much describe similar things all across the board, and I've heard some vocalizations myself. Now, I really think that these vocalizations fall into several categories, and those categories can be described as the distance over which the communication is intended for. You kind of long-distance communications, mid-range, and then close-up. Long-distance communications tend to be of a couple of types. You'll have a scream. I call it the war scream. And I don't mean war as in let's go to war. I mean war as in the kind of sound that it makes. It's like a war. Very, very high-pitched, though. And then you also have a siren type of a call that can start real low and go real high. But what's weird about it, it's like an air raid siren. It holds a note for a long time. It goes like, whoa, and it just continues on at that note for a long time before dropping off.
Now, do you have either of those examples in what you can play for us tonight, audio that you, Autumn Williams, have been able to capture over the years?
Now, I have some files that you guys have downloaded off of my public site that
right.
Are, I would say, the Puyallup screams are they're a good example of that war scream I was talking about. They're not very clear. They were recorded back in 1973. On my members section, I have a whole bunch more audio, but I didn't have, you guys called me this morning, so I didn't have any opportunity to get any clearances from anybody that audio has come from.
Well, tell me about clearances. What does that mean? I was kind of curious about that because there was a couple of the ones that were on the non-member portion of your website that apparently we don't have clearance for. But clearance from who and for what?
Well, the clearance would be from the person who recorded the screams, who would be the copyright owner of that. The screams that are on the public section they've been in the public domain pretty much for a long time, and I can't tell you whether or not they're technically in the public domain. I have them on the site, you know, for viewing under the fair use doctrine for education. But when I get scream recordings from people, when people send me vocalizations, what I do is I get permission from them to use them in the limited basis of putting them on the website, and then for any other usage, I have to go back to them and ask whether or not they're okay with that.
You may be the first person to ever put something up on a website that I know of, I mean, and I think you're hip to what I'm talking about here, that ever would think that somehow that wouldn't get downloaded and sent to about 1,000 places. So I, God bless.
No. In my members section, the files actually aren't downloadable, and that's the whole point. You can download them and listen to them within a window, but they are not downloadable so that you can upload them somewhere else. And that's part of how I protect the agreement that I have with the people who allow me to post them is that they will not be posted elsewhere out of context. I promise them that if I post them on my site, they will be posted there within the context with the person's own words about et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they're not posted elsewhere out of context.
Let's go ahead and play. I guess we can play cut two. And so we'll play this here, and then you can tell us afterward what we're hearing and what you hear in it. This is Autumn Williams from her website, which you can link up to at coasttocoastam.com. Go ahead and play cut two. That's very interesting. What do you think that represents? What type of vocalization is that indicative of?
Now, we're getting into more of the mid-range vocalizations, whoops, whistles, and woos, the three W's. As far as that goes, we have no way of knowing whether or not any of these recordings are indicative of a Sasquatch vocalization for 100% positive. We don't know.
Okay.
Dave Cleveland, however, recorded that on his property in 1972 after he had a sighting. It was up in Estacada, Oregon. I have not been able to match that to any known sound. If any of your listeners out there can match that to a known bit of wildlife, I certainly would be interested in hearing about it. But that sound also, what fascinates me is that these certain recordings represent what so many witnesses have described to me in reports. They describe them phonetically. They describe, you know, they describe the octave. They describe the length, the duration, the frequency of the calls. And then you get a recording like this, you know, that perfectly represents that high-pitched wooing sound. You know, they'll tell you it's a hollow, loud, almost a whistling woo.
Okay.
And then you get a recording like this.
And so that fits the description that you would hear typically from somebody who they want to tell you, well, this is what I heard. Do they usually hear that in conjunction with seeing something?
Often, yeah. I mean, your ideal scenario with vocalizations is going to be, you know, I had a sighting and I saw this creature making this sound. We
right.
have a few of those. And so, you know, that's how we kind of pin down what the most likely vocalizations are. And then when we get these recordings and a witness says, you know, I found big footprints on my property, something came up and hit my house, you know, something killed my dog, and then this was recorded during that time period, you know, Occam's razor would tell you that the most likely scenario is probably the right one. And, you know, is it coincidence that those sounds are recorded at the same time that those goings on are happening? Probably not.
Okay. This is cut three. Let's play this, and then we'll get more from Autumn Williams here on Coast to Coast AM. Kiris? Okay. Tell me about that.
1973, Puyallup, Washington, there was a large gravel pit on, I believe it was the south side of Puyallup. And for, I think it was a couple of weeks, there was a screamer. They called it the Puyallup Screamer in the gravel pit. There were sightings during that time and whatnot. You can hear that one actually was recorded during the day. There's birdsong and a train whistle in the background. That scream... Now, get this. That scream is identical to, let's see, that's Puyallup, 1973. I have ones from Snohomish, 1978-79, that are the same. The Klamath screams were recorded in 1993 in Klamath, California. Those are the same. And I also have a couple of sound files that I do not have permission to publicize or post.
Okay, well then we'll hear more about that coming up then in just a minute. Autumn Williams with more audio from Bigfoot next. Talking with Autumn Williams, we'll give you the phone numbers at the top of the hour so you can join the conversation, too. We're playing cuts from her website, which you can link up to at coasttocoastam.com while you're there. You can also take a look at some of the other top stories for the day. Lots of them very interesting. But it's the Bigfoot audio that is going tonight. We'll get a couple more examples of that. But I also want to hear from Autumn next about her best, most graphic, most memorable Bigfoot encounter on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Autumn Williams has spent most of her own lifetime tracking stories and capturing evidence on Bigfoot, but it's part of a family tradition. In fact, Autumn, how many times would you say your whole family included, you've had some sort of Bigfoot encounter?
Well, you got to realize all of this happened back in the late 70s, and we were living in a little town called Ording in the foothills of Mount Rainier. My mom actually, she finally wrote a book about it. I asked her for years to write the entire story down, and she wrote it down, and she wrote it for me, and it was never intended to be published, but it got picked up by a publisher, and it's called Valley of the Skookum, and that chronicles all of the information, all the things that happened. My mother and I had a sighting when I was very young. My sister had a sighting. My father had a sighting. And then, of course, our neighbors saw two adults and two juveniles playing in her yard, and she and her husband watched them for, hours during the dawn. So it was pretty regular occurrence around there. Long-term witnesses don't necessarily, they don't walk out in their backyard and see Bigfoot every day. It's not like that, but there's indications that they're around. And what fascinates me about those kind of situations is these gift-giving scenarios and that kind of thing. The witnesses will leave food out or little gifts, little trinkets and things, and those will be taken and things will be left in return. So the interactions aren't always face-to-face.
Such as what? What would be left in return presumably by a Bigfoot as a return gift?
Well, the things that are left are generally, sometimes they're what they consider to be food items, an animal or something like that, a carcass. But more often than not, it's something like strange stones, and it's usually in a pattern formation. There will be stones in a circle or sticks in a little teepee in the spot where your gift was left. The gift disappears, and then you have like a little teepee of sticks or a little triangle of sticks or maybe some pine cones or feathers or, something like that.
If I were to watch... I look out my window all the time. If I saw a bunch of squirrels running around my front lawn, I wouldn't find in any way any reason to grab a camera and take a picture.
Right.
If they were standing on their hind legs and they were playing patty cake or they were doing something that was so incredibly unusual for squirrels, I might be inclined to take a picture. And I would come back to the camera question when it comes to Bigfoot, that if I were to look out my window, even in a rural Oregon setting, and I saw two adult males and two juveniles frolicking around in my lawn, I think I would be inclined to want to capture that on film somehow. I want to take a photo of that. I know you said earlier that people get so used to it, it's not a big deal, but I would think that would be... Even for the most jaded forest dweller, that would still be an amazing sight.
You own a camera, correct? These people did not.
They would not own a camera. They didn't own a camera.
This in this particular instance, these people were they were just like us. I mean, we were dirt poor. We were living in a tar paper shack.
Okay.
With holes in the floor so big you could throw a cat through them. And, I mean, a lot of these people, even nowadays, I mean, they live way out in rural areas, and they are not, fiscally sound. They
okay.
don't have equipment. They don't have cameras. They don't have things. And if they do have cameras, the thing is that, I really don't know how to stress this enough. It sounds like an excuse. And it's not an excuse. These people don't want to compromise the trust that they're building with these creatures by grabbing a camera and trying to sneak around and take pictures of them.
Well, you wouldn't have to. If you had a camera in your house and you looked out the window and there was a Bigfoot walking by, you could take a photo without ruining the integrity of the relationship. Presumably, the Bigfoot wouldn't even know if there were a flash to be used, what that flash was.
If that creature is walking out in the open, and if you have your camera nearby and can get it soon enough, and if it's daytime, I mean, there's a lot of ifs. There's in our minds, we look at this and we think, oh, well, gee, that's just simple. You just take a picture. But it's not that simple. And you're right. People, when it comes to the subject of Bigfoot, people are so hung up on photographs. It is unbelievable. I liken it to us being Sasquatch paparazzi.
I don't think so.
Everybody wants a picture. Everybody wants a souvenir.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, I talk to my long-term witnesses, and if I were to say to them, hey, go out and get me a picture, they'd say, no, I've been working on this habituation for 5 years. I'm not going to run out, and the next time I have an encounter, pull this thing out of my pocket and aim it at this thing and start flashing off a flashbulb at it. I'm going to ruin everything that I've worked so hard for so long.
You lose me there. Because, like, how would the Bigfoot even know what that thing is that they pulled out of a pocket?
And that's where it gets real sticky. That's the sticky wicket. That gets into a whole other ball of wax. Because
I don't understand any of that, what that meant. What do you mean? I mean,
I know, because it's such a big topic that we can't possibly cover it right now, but I can touch on it for you.
Okay.
Researchers in the mainstream research community are convinced that this thing is a throwback to Gigantopithecus blackie. Why? Well, because that's pseudoscientific, and by postulating that, I think they think that it lends more credence to, I mean, the more scientific you can make Bigfoot research sound, the better, because everybody wants Bigfoot research to to gain credence in the scientific community. But the deal is, Gigantopithecus was basically a bipedal big dumb monkey, right? I mean, it was a big monkey. It was a big gorilla that walked on its hind legs. How many times have you read a report where an eyewitness says, and I couldn't believe it, the look on this thing's face, it looked just like a big dumb monkey. I can't think of one, and I've read thousands of reports, but I can point you to dozens upon dozens of reports where the eyewitness said, I couldn't believe how human its facial expression was. And what every long-term witness, and I mean every single one without a doubt, has told me is that these things aren't animals. They do not act like animals. They do not interact like animals. And so I really wonder if mainstream researchers are chasing a Bigfoot that doesn't exist. I'm not saying that Bigfoot doesn't exist. I'm saying that perhaps this idea that they have of this Bigfoot being a throwback to Gigantopithecus blackie doesn't exist.
Well, okay, but I guess that still doesn't answer to the point about cameras. I mean, even if it's more humanoid in its features, even if it is less of a primate and more of a human-leaning hominid, it's still, they wouldn't have any context for a camera. So if somebody pulled a camera out of their pocket and took a snap, how are they going to feel violated? How are the Bigfoot going to be able to process that and say, oh, they're ruining our habituation. Our relationship is over. I feel threatened by the fact that they took a camera. They wouldn't, I mean, a camera wouldn't have any more significance than a piece of pie or a turkey leg.
How are they going to know the difference between a camera and a gun?
I don't get your point.
Well, Ian, the point is that, I mean, you know, a camera can seem as threatening as a gun. If you don't know what it is, I mean, if they've been shot at by a gun, you know, you pull this thing out and point it at them. Well, okay, you pull a camera out and point it at them. It could be perceived as just as threatening. I don't know. I haven't sat down and personally asked a Sasquatch, what do you think about cameras? But The deal is, you know, Tom Powell, for instance, he's a gentleman who wrote the book The Locals, which I think is just a fabulous book. And he did a wireless wilderness project for a long time where he had cameras out in the wilderness. And he discovered some things that suggested to him that the Sasquatches avoided cameras like the plague. And I know other researchers who have found their cameras destroyed.
That's fine. I guess it speaks to sort of a larger thing, and maybe part of this is just sort of colored by my conversations with Todd. And that I get this feeling from you too that almost the power of this comes from the lack of proof. That the more one lacks proof, the more one has power over how the story is told. I think that there are a lot of people that feel really interested in, you know, like, you know, there's all sorts of different species that at one point had been considered to be mythical, you know, the things that couldn't possibly true. And people said there's no such thing as a lowland gorilla. Well, at some point, somebody gets a picture of a lowland gorilla and, you know, the world goes on. It keeps turning. I mean, just getting a picture of something doesn't mean it's going to bring either the research, the relationship, or the species to a screeching halt.
It goes back to what we're talking about with long-term witness situations. And the deal is that regardless, I don't know how better to explain this, regardless of whether or not pulling a camera out and taking a picture of a Bigfoot would ruin a habituation, witnesses perceive it as so, and so they're reluctant to pull out a camera.
Okay, let's listen to audio from cut 4. This is from Autumn Williams' website, which you can link up to at coasttocoastam.com. Let's listen to it, and then she'll tell us about it afterward. Go ahead, Kiris. Okay, tell us about that.
And that was recorded in Snohomish, Washington in 1978. The lady who recorded that was a long-term witness, and she was a friend of our neighbor. Those were recorded, I believe, shortly after the time when our encounters were heated up the most. So she was having kind of simultaneous stuff going on. I think it was about 50 miles north of where we were. And that is one of the most intense clips off of that entire audio file where the thing is just screaming and screaming and screaming. Now, interestingly enough, these also were recorded, like the Puyallup screams, in a gravel pit. I have, over the last 17 years, noticed this frequency of reports coming from gravel pits, particularly scream reports that are relatively consistent. I mean, these things will go to the gravel pits and scream night after night after night. I still have no idea. I have some ideas, but I really don't understand why gravel pits show up in these scream reports so often, but they do.
Perhaps they like the way their sound echoes in there?
It could be, but I actually went to that the Puyallup gravel pit and did a few screams myself. I drove all the way up to Puyallup, Washington, just to try this because I was curious, like you, about the acoustics. And when I got up there and I screamed in the gravel pit, it was pretty acoustically dead. There was really no echo, which I was expecting, you know, a lot of echo. So I don't know. I'm not sure why that is, but.
Okay.
Puyallup, Snohomish, there was a screamer down in Strawberry, California. There was one in Texas. There was one up in the Dalles, Oregon. On and on and on and on and on.
Let's listen to a cut 5 from Autumn Williams and then find out more about it in just a second. Go ahead.
Thank you.
At first, it sounded kind of higher and more bird-like, but then at the end, was that grunt associated
with... That was actually the small dog that was sitting on her porch next to her. She used to go out. For a nine-month period, she would sit on her porch almost every night in the wee hours of the morning and record this thing screaming, whistling in the gravel pit. And often there were some of the recordings that I have in the member section have more than one creature kind of communicating back and forth. That last clip was an excellent example of the high-pitched, what we refer to as whistles. I don't know if they're whistling, if they're actually doing that with their vocal cords. I'm not sure. But the very end of that, there's like a yoo-hoo. There's like a high-pitched and a lower-pitched.
Right.
That exact whistle I heard while at Laos Camp down near the Patterson film site in 1993. We were sitting near the campfire, and I heard that yoo-hoo whistle that came from just across the creek, and it was so loud and so hollow. I had no time to grab a recorder. I didn't have one running at the time. We were sitting around like playing guitar and just talking around the campfire. And it didn't repeat, but it was so loud and so clear and just unbelievable volume and identical to that in pitch.
All right. And so what year was that one recorded, the one we just heard?
That was also 1978. That was the same woman that we knew who lived 50 miles north of us.
All right. Finally, here's cut 8. We're going to roll that back at the studio with Autumn Williams. Go ahead. Okay. That sounds painful.
A little different, yeah. Recorded in Westmoreland County, Pennsylvania in 1973, I believe. That was also in a gravel pit. There was a creature that was being sighted, and as what usually happens, a whole posse of guys went out and had their guns. And the story behind that one is that the thing was actually shot, and it was off in the bushes around the gravel pit, I believe is how that story goes. And then that was recorded there after the thing was shot at.
So after he was shot at or shot?
I believe he was shot. I believe it was actually hit.
All right. Roll that if you would again, Curious, cut 8. Okay. And yet, do they go down later? Do they find a physical evidence of him having either A, been shot, or B, any of the find a body?
You know, I'm embarrassed to say I have about 1,500 Bigfoot stories in my head, names, dates, places, and all that, and I cannot remember everything surrounding that one. I have it. I know I'm getting parts of it confused with the story from Strawberry. There was another recording that was recorded over by a police officer, recorded over his CB, and was recorded back to the base unit, and that's kind of a strange recording, and I think I'm getting the details of those two mixed up. So
okay,
rather than giving you false information, I'll say at this point I don't know.
Okay.
Beyond what I told you.
We'll leave that there then for the moment, and we'll come back. We'll give you all the numbers of our last hour ahead on Coast to Coast AM, and you can join in the conversation. You've heard 5 different cuts from Autumn Williams and 1 from Todd Standing before that. You're the jukebox jury. What do you hear in those? And if you're a hunter, do you hear that sort of noise all the time? Next on Coast to Coast AM.